Hello and welcome to another episode of Twimmel Talk, the podcast where I interview interesting people doing interesting things in machine learning and artificial intelligence. I'm your host, Sam Charrington. I want to send a quick thanks to everyone who commented on and shared last week's show with Jeff Dean. We were super excited to share that show with you, and the feedback and love you sent our way was amazing. Weeks like last are how we expand the Twimmel community and get into the ears of people who don't know about us yet. All your shares, likes, tweets, and retweets matter a great deal to us, so thanks. Before I introduce today's show, the details for April's Twimmel online meetup are set. Join us on April 18th at 5 p.m. Pacific time as Chris Butler dives headfirst into the topic of trust in AI, covering a myriad of papers in the process. To register or for more details, head on over to twimmelai.com/meetup. In this episode, I'm joined by David Rosenberg, data scientist in the office of the CTO at financial publisher Bloomberg, to discuss his work on extracting data from tables and charts in natural document formats. Bloomberg deals with tons of financial and company data in PDFs and other unstructured document formats on a daily basis. To make meaning from this information more efficiently, David and his team have implemented a deep learning pipeline for extracting data from the documents. In our conversation, we dig into the information extraction process, including how it was built, how they source their training data, why they use LaTeX as an intermediate representation, and how and why they optimize for pixel-perfect accuracy. There's a lot of interesting info in this show, and I think you're going to really enjoy it. All right, everyone, I am on the line with David Rosenberg. David is a data scientist in the CTO's office at Bloomberg, the financial publisher. He's also an adjunct associate professor in the Center for Data Science at NYU. David, welcome to This Week in Machine Learning and AI.
Thanks so much. Happy to be here.
Awesome. It's our tradition to have our guests start by introducing themselves to the audience. So tell us, how did you get involved in data science and machine learning?
Yeah, sure. Man, I've been interested in AI since I was a kid, reading science fiction books in elementary school about robots and artificial intelligence really grabbed my interest. And I guess it was in eighth grade, there was a summer program and we got to build these Fisher Technic kit projects. That's kind of like a motorized and computer controllable Lego kit, but it was made by this company, Fisher Technic. And I loved it. I thought it was most amazing thing to be able to control a kind of a robot-like device with computer programming. And then a few years later, then I guess in high school then, I started hearing about neural networks, which was my first exposure to machine learning. And yeah, for a project, I bought a textbook and I implemented a neural network to do some classification on some medical data. And yeah, frankly, at the time, I didn't really understand very well how the neural network was working at the detailed mathematical level, but I had a taste of the ML framework, even I was like early 90s.
That's pretty amazing that you were exposed to neural nets in high school. Where did you go to high school?
I went to Montgomery Blair High School in Silver Spring, Maryland. It was a math science, computer science magnet program. I don't even remember how I first heard about neural networks, but somehow they came to my attention and found a way to special order these books at the local Barnes & Noble. Yeah, and I coded it up in Pascal.
Nice, nice. How did you end up at Bloomberg and what's your focus there?
Right. So yeah, two hops to Bloomberg. So after grad school, I moved to New York and I joined a startup company that was kind of Tony Jabara, who's a machine learning professor, who's a machine learning professor from Columbia. Now he's at Netflix. I joined his startup company. We're doing a lot of spatial temporal data, machine learning based on spatial temporal data. And then eventually got into mobile advertising. So doing things like building bidders for ad exchanges and those kind of fun problems that a lot of ML gets applied to these days. We got acquired by YP, which is Yellow Pages. And I stayed there for about a year or so. And then I looked for my next step and I ended up at Bloomberg, where at Bloomberg, I'm in the office of the CTO. And it's a small group, I think about 25 people total. Within that group, there's a 5-person data science group that I'm a member of. And kind of our task is to work on strategic projects or plan strategic projects on kind of a 2 to 4 year time horizon. Things that are a little bit too long term for any individual engineering group to really plan for. So we kind of make strategic initiatives and kind of point the data science part of the company in different directions. So that's kind of the big picture. Another way we think about it is, if some other company were to gain a large advantage over Bloomberg because of some new technology in data science that we did not pursue, that would be our fault. Mm. That we're responsible for making sure we're not missing out on important new tech developments.
Right. Can you give us some examples of the kinds of things that you're looking at or have looked at in the past that kind of fall into this 2 to 4 year timeframe?
Sure, I can. So one thing, maybe not quite so such a long-term play, but when I joined maybe 3 years ago, there was kind of machine learning was at this interesting time where neural networks were, you know, starting to do very well on many tasks, but just kind of specific tasks, like certainly vision and some NLP tasks. But it was kind of, to get into neural networks, it's a pretty big investment in terms of hardware. At Bloomberg, we don't have kind of the ability to use the Amazon cloud or something. We need to use internal machines. So the CTO office kind of led the movement to try out neural networks, which involves, you know, investing in the cluster of GPU machines and seeding projects with various engineering teams to see if neural networks was going to benefit the types of problems that we work on. And yeah, indeed, we have found, you know, within a couple of years that it's very important to some areas of the work that we do. So I consider that strategic, not so much because of the time horizon, but because of the investment required that was kind of too large for any individual engineering group to take that risk.
I guess I'm curious about the evolution of the use of machine learning at a company like Bloomberg. And you said, how long have you been there now?
I've been coming up on 3 years.
Coming up on 3 years. So maybe you'll have a sense of this. Like, I talk to people all the time about like how enterprises, large businesses kind of evolve these types of technologies. And it's interesting, you know, in that there are some businesses where, you know, there are parts of the business that have used machine learning for a really long time. Like it's been baked into, you know, just core ways that they deliver their products, but yet and still, even at those businesses, there's been like a shift over the past 5 years in the way they've thought about machine learning. And I'm just curious, like in your words, like does any of that resonate, and how have you seen that evolve at Bloomberg?
Yeah, so I think Bloomberg was fairly early in bringing machine learning into their product, which I could tell you a little bit about. But I think machine learning at Bloomberg was well underway. I mean, you know, there's close to 100 people doing machine learning at Bloomberg before I even arrived. Mm-hmm. So I can't really speak to how that developed. But I can say that even now we're continually trying to find areas where machine learning can help via by automation or just kind of maybe more broadly than machine learning, just a good data science statistical approach to assessing new, even if it's a rules-based method, to use kind of proper methodology in assessing performance and these sorts of things. In fact, to that end, to try to see where we can leverage ML more or data science more at Bloomberg, Another strategic initiative that is almost a year old now, coming from the CTO department, is what we're calling ML-EDU, so machine learning education. But the purview is broader than ML. It's kind of just data science more broadly. And we're trying to kind of educate people at all different levels, basically from the kind of most basic understanding of the main concepts of machine learning, things like the notion of splitting your data into training and test, and the notions of overfitting, kind of these fundamental ideas of machine learning that we have a course called ML1, which is 2 half days, and it's a few hours lecture and a few hours lab where people go through that. And that kind of gives people just a sense of what is this ML about. And then we have, at the other extreme, we have a kind of fairly in-depth course called ML101, which is kind of like a master's level machine learning class. It's kind of fairly mathematical, but with practical end, which is learning all the connections between things like gradient boosting and random forest and L1, L2 regularization, kind of a standard master's level machine learning class. So, and we're trying to fill in everything in between. So how to manipulate data, explore data, visualize it, how to do basic statistics, things like A-B testing, hypothesis testing, confidence intervals, and then machine learning, kind of okay. predictive theory.
Awesome. I am shortly going to be jumping on a plane to head out to the Bay Area for the GTC conference.
Yeah.
And you will too. Probably not before me, since I'm getting on a plane in a few hours. But you're going to be presenting there on what is presumably one of these projects within the CTO's office, you know, data science team that you've been working on. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. So the title is Information Extraction for Natural Document Formats. So natural document format, to my knowledge, is not really a common terminology, but we encountered a lot at Bloomberg. And what we mean by that is a document that was designed for easy human consumption and comprehension, things like a Word document, a PDF document. And in particular, what we have in mind for the projects I'll be speaking about is where there's some kind of underlying data that is represented or that are represented in this natural document format in a way that's just fine for a person to comprehend, but is not easy at all to extract that data back out into, say, a database or an Excel spreadsheet or something like that. And this is a problem that we have a lot of at Bloomberg.
So an example of this might be like a chart or a graph or something like that? Is that the...
Absolutely. Yeah. Okay. So a scatter plot, a pie chart, a bar chart, or a table of numbers. You know, a table of all things you'd think should be very easy to, extract the data out into an Excel spreadsheet or a database or something. But when a table is just represented in a PDF document in the middle of a, say, company filing, Bloomberg collects all these documents from other companies, things like company filings and these sorts of things. And these documents that they deliver in a PDF format typically has important data in it that we need to extract so that it's easy for our Bloomberg's customers to use, to get to. And so traditionally, you know, I think almost since the founding of the company 30 years ago, there's been a whole organization within the company called Global Data, where it's people's jobs to figure out the most efficient and most correct way to extract this information from the documents. And there's, I can't say exactly how much, but, you know, certainly at least hundreds of people working on these problems. And it's been going on for 30 years. So it started off, you know, mostly by hand. And a big effort over the years has been to see how to automate this as much as possible or make it more efficient for the people doing it. That's kind of the business driver.
In this particular scenario, I kind of thought this was a solved problem. Like for 10 years now, I thought that, you know, financial filings, I thought there was like the development of some standardized XML formats that were used for you know, S1s and all these financial filings now. It sounds like that it's, I know that maybe, you know, some of, you know, the largest companies kind of submit their things via these XML formats, but there's still a ton of traditional documents flying around with this information.
There sure are. And, you know, maybe it's a letter to shareholders that is, you know, not necessarily regulated. There's no requirements on the format to use. And we kind of want to get as much data as we can. And even if the US were to go in a certain direction, there's still all the other countries that may or may not have these requirements. And so, yes, in some sense, perhaps someday everyone will kind of publish all their, any data that show up in any inconvenient document will be paired with a, you know, some kind of standard XML format, but we're certainly not there yet.
Interesting. So tell me about the approach you're taking with this.
Sure. So there's kind of three different tasks that I'll be talking about. One of them is as far as extracting data from tables that show up in documents. And the first task there is to just find the tables in the PDF documents. So for that, we're using a fairly off-the-shelf image detection methods. The same things you would use to find a cat or a kite or whatever it is in an image. One advantage that we have is because we've been solving this problem by hand for so many years, we have a tremendous amount of labeled training data. Mm-hmm. And so now we're able to leverage that to build models. And one interesting aspect we have is we basically can't afford to automate unless the performance will be at least as good as a human's. And so before we're willing to cut a human out of the loop completely. And so, in fact, we've done that for this relatively straightforward problem of, at least for some kind of sub-problems of finding charts and documents, we've been able to exceed human precision and recall, which was great. And then the downstream tasks of actually extracting the numbers from the table use some other techniques for. And so that's the second thing that I am going to talk about in the presentation, which is a little bit futuristic. It's not something that we kind of, it's purely research right now. It's not something we're planning to productize anytime soon because it's kind of a long path. But we were inspired by this image captioning work that started a few years ago where you could show a picture of a man crossing the street and it would produce using an image to sequence model the sentence, man cross the street or something like that. Mm-hmm. And the idea was like, boy, if we could feed in a page of a document and have it output directly in one step, kind of a well-structured XML or JSON or standardized formatting of all the content in that kind of picture of the page of the document, wouldn't that be great? Then you could, because that's so much easier. There's so much you can do with that downstream as far as automated processing that it's hard to begin if you just have kind of a raw PDF. The format, if I could show you the format of the internal of a PDF or even a parsed PDF is not very easy to extract the structure from. Hmm. So for that problem, so how are we going to apply image captioning to this sort of thing? So I partnered with a student from Harvard, Yuntian Dang, who had this really cool work a year or two ago with Sasha Rush and some others, was to convert a picture of an equation, a mathematical equation that was generated by LaTeX, which is a kind of markup for making equations and scientific documents, and to go from the image and reproduce LaTeX code that you would need to generate that equation.
Oh, interesting.
You can see as kind of a simple version of going from the image of something to a structured representation of kind of the underlying information in the picture that you can then do further information extraction on. So we wanted to adapt that idea to this problem of information extraction from tables. So given the image of a table, we're restricting here to kind of somewhat of a toy problem where we assume the table is generated from LaTeX in the first place, from a LaTeX document. And so the problem is, can we regenerate the LaTeX code that would reproduce that table exactly, kind of pixel level exact? And so that's another thing I'll be talking about. We had some fairly impressive results for that. The kind of the exact match rate isn't so high. Maybe it's 40%, but the errors are, even when it makes errors, they're pretty minor. So this seems like an interesting line of work that mm-hmm. we're pursuing. And the last thing was extracting data from scatter plots. So in a document, there'll often be scatter plots or plots containing information. And, you know, we found ourselves once or twice with the ruler trying to figure out exactly what points are represented in this chart. You know, lining up the point with the axis.
Right.
It seems like, boy, this should be automatable with all the computer vision technologies we have now. And, you know, this was an interesting thing where we actually thought that this was close enough to something we could make a product out of that we kind of went straight for what's the most direct way to solve this problem without, you know, it's very tempting to try to make kind of the end-to-end solution that are, you know, so striking these days with the neural networks. Like, for instance, the image of the table to the LaTeX code that produces it. That would be, I consider that an end-to-end solution. But so we were tempted to make the input, the chart, and the output just be the list of points in one fell swoop. But that seemed to be a little bit too hard for right now for us. So we broke that down into a pipeline of steps, each one of which was just using off-the-shelf techniques. We started with kind of image recognition to find the components of the charts. Then we used some various heuristics to put them together. And in the end, I could do a fairly good job of extracting the data from scatter plots. And currently we're working on pie charts. And next, I guess, would be bar charts and line charts. And I mean, the goal is to solve the problem in this particular case rather than to come up with a very kind of one-shot end-to-end solution.
Right. So the first of the problems you described was just really localizing these graphical...
The tables.
The tables in particular or
tables and charts. Tables and charts. But yeah. We were focusing particularly on the tables initially.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And if you're just looking at tables and charts, like I'm curious, how much of the PDF internals do you actually use, or do you just like take a picture of the page essentially and do your image recognition on the page itself?
Yeah, good question. So the punchline is that it can do just fine using just a picture. So if you treat each PDF page as a picture, just render it and use that as input, that works just fine. Initially, we were concerned that it would be too hard. So we tried to use a parse of the PDF to simplify the image. So for instance, we figured, it doesn't really need to know exactly what characters are there. Maybe it just needs to know the character type, like letter versus number, this sort of thing.
Okay.
So maybe we can render a simpler version of the page that would be easier for the object detection system to learn from. But it turns out it works just fine with the rendering of the raw. I mean, sometimes one works a little better, sometimes the other works a little better, but it can go directly from the rendered image.
So the result of this first step is just, is it like a bounding box and a label that says table or chart, or
it is a bounding box. And it sounds, when I first heard about it, I felt like this is sounds so easy. Why are they fuss like, about it? I'm sure everyone's thinking that, and it mostly is. But the issue is that if you don't get the bounding box exactly right, if you leave off a column or leave off some of the header, or you don't properly separate the headers from the rest of the table, which is another part of finding the table in the first place, mm-hmm. then the entire extraction is messed up. So, and kind of 95% accuracy isn't really good enough. So it's always about the, again, if I had pictures, I could show you some. So if you go to the presentation, we could show you some really weird looking tables that heuristics just will fail on.
This is actually really, really easy for me to visualize. And the reason why is because I often use my cell phone camera to take pictures of receipts or pages or things like that. And the particular app that I use, you know, whether it's, there are several that I use, Evernote is one, Cam Scanner is another. But these apps will try to, you know, do exactly what you're describing, like draw a bounding box around the document and then like use that to like, you know, rewarp it or straighten it and crop it from the background. but it is uncanny the mistakes that these things will make and how, you know, I don't think the accuracy is anywhere near 95% on, you know, what, you know, even if I've got the paper on a black notebook or something like that, like it still seems to be a challenging problem. And, you know, it's perhaps complicated by the fact that it's running on a mobile device. I don't know. But I can certainly imagine if you now kind of, you know, you don't even have the benefit of the contrasting background. You've got all different kinds of, you know, shapes and sizes of tables and, you know, adjacency of one table to the next. And, you know, I can, you know, I said, is it, you know, just this issue of creating the bounding box? But as you're describing this, I can imagine all of the complexities associated with getting this right.
Right. Yeah. And you nailed one of the challenges, which is when tables are adjacent, the problem of multiple columns, you know, there's often two column or three column documents. Yeah. I think you appreciate the, it's harder than it sounds.
Is this a system that you've tried to or gotten to the point of operationalizing yet, or is this?
Yep. This is deployed. This is okay. In deployment. So this is in is kind of in the pipeline, helping people. It's assisting people to annotate documents. So someone will load the document. The document will be kind of pre-annotated with a guess by this system of finding the tables. And then a human can approve or edit those annotations. And then for some classes of documents, it's just straight pass through with no human oversight needed, we've decided.
That was going to be my exact question. Like, do you, you know, are you utilizing a model where you identify like a, or you kind of surface when the system isn't sure to the user and allow the, you know, that human in the loop to kind of make the final decision when there's some uncertainty, or, you know, does it have to be kind of all or nothing? It sounds like mm-hmm. you are kind of doing that, you know, taking that middle ground where you're surfacing the, you know, where there's some ambiguity.
Right. So, yes. Yeah, so I think what one thing that you seem to be speaking about is where the system will perhaps based on, you know, what it sees, and it will give a measured response. Like, you know, I think this is the bounding box, but my confidence is low, or they may give a numeric score to the confidence or something.
Right.
And then the ones that are low confidence will be highlighted to a user. What we feel safer with for now is finding classes of documents that overall have a very high performance, kind of above human level accuracy or precision recall measures. And as a group, those will be kind of passed through. Because the issue with confidence is that you have to trust the confidence measure. You have to trust the confidence score. And so that would have to be kind of assessed on its own.
Okay. How are these classes of documents described? Like, is it, you know, all of the, you know, S1s for major Fortune, you know, 500 companies all kind of look the same, or all of AT&T's S1s we've got good performance on, or that kind of thing?
Right. It'd be like a class of documents, like filings of a certain type, for example, that have such a certain regularity to them, and the performance is very high, that will kind of shunt those to automatic pass through, which is to say it doesn't need a human oversight.
Okay. And it sounds like by implication then when you know, when the system's nailed a document class,
yeah,
it's confident, well, you know, aside from confidence, like it performs extremely well, like, you know, above human levels of performance on every document in that class. There's not a lot of variability within the class.
Yeah, that's the idea. Right. You'd like a more fine-grained certainty measure that one could leverage.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know that it's like, I guess I would expect that even within a document class, there are still ambiguous situations, and I would expect you to want to somehow kind of surface that ambiguity, but you don't want to do that. You want it to be kind of all or nothing, and I'm really trying to get into the thinking there.
Well, I you know, it's interesting. I think part of it is the way our annotation system works. That the annotation system works at the document level, so you know, a document, okay, maybe 10 to 50 pages. And in some sense, we either have a person annotate a document or we don't. We at this point don't have a kind of page by page decision on whether it will be annotated.
Okay.
So I think that's part of it. That's a bit of it. Perhaps an idiosyncrasy of our setup.
Right, right. So if you could just throw ambiguous pages on a stack and, you know, someone goes through those page by page, then that might have changed the way you approach that piece.
I think that's right.
Yeah.
Although I think being able to trust the confidence score is an interesting problem in and of itself. It's very, most machine learning methods these days output something that you are tempted to interpret as a probability, but whether those for a probability of for classification, for instance, probability of being a cat versus not a cat, mm-hmm. Sorts of things.
Right.
But whether those probabilities are calibrated in the sense that it will actually be right that number of times when you predict cat is that has to be confirmed. That's just because a method gives a probability score doesn't mean that's actually the probability, I guess.
Right. Right. There's an implicit weighting of kind of trusting that confidence versus like assuming that it's 100% and kind of pushing those documents through. Like I don't have an intuitive feel for why that trust is any better than, even in the case where you've got general high level of trust in a class, mm-hmm. like you might, in that case, seems like there'd be information in a low confidence, an exceedingly low confidence level for a document.
Right. So I think
assuming
you're
saying you had the infrastructure,
we should do even better.
Yeah. So I guess that's all I'm saying.
So we have a class of documents, which without any information about the individual pages or the individual document, the overall performance will be say 98% precision and recall while human is 97 or 98. Okay. So match or exceed human performance. And then you're pointing out, maybe we could do even better by going page by page and highlighting the ones that are somewhat less certain and maybe sending those to a human, and then we can do even better overall. Yeah, I agree with that.
Yeah, right. Yeah, no, I appreciate you putting it like that. It's certainly not my job to, there's often a way to do better, but then there are, the trade-offs that, come with trying to doing that. And if you've achieved a level of performance that you need for your use case, then, great.
Yeah. So for the pass-through, it's not even 97, 98. It's like essentially 100.
Oh, really?
The one for like 90, for the 96, 97, I think those still go to humans. I'm not 100% sure. I'd have to double check that.
And so another kind of thought that I'm wondering if you are thinking about and tracking is the whole kind of adversarial attack conversation and some scenario where, a company kind of, manipulates the presentation of their data to, change the way your parser interprets their charts and tables and, somehow affect trades of Bloomberg customers. Like, I'm assuming that's something that you folks are thinking about.
I mean, that's really important. So there's a little bit of that we've already seen where there'll be a document that if you look at it to the eye, nothing unusual going on. But if you parse it with a PDF parser, which tries to extract kind of the text and stuff for you, what we found is some documents will put incorrect information or confusing information in a kind of invisible font color. Mm. And so when you parse it, it's very difficult to figure out what's going on. If you use like a PDF parser.
Huh.
But we've been able to get around those because we just use the rendering of the page. And so if a human can't see it, the network can figure out what are kind of relevant colors and irrelevant colors and that sort of thing.
Right.
But we're not protected against not necessarily protected against adversarial images that could mess up a network, but a human wouldn't see. I mean, I don't know how that would work through after being printed out and stuff. I assume it would. But yeah, of course, we've seen, I assume you're talking about these pretty cool examples where there'll be a picture that's clearly a cat and the classifier will give it 99% confidence that it's a car or something like
exactly,
that.
Exactly.
Right. That's really interesting. We haven't noticed things like that happening, but it's definitely something we need to keep an eye out for. Yeah.
I like the way you describe the tricks that folks do with like kind of background colored text. Makes me think of, and it just struck me that like in some ways you can think of like fine print and some of these things as like adversarial attacks against the human brain, right? It's like
right.
Yeah, things we do to like, you know, present information so as to mislead the reader.
Right.
So the first part is identifying these tables and charts. The second part is then parsing the tables. And you talked about you know, some of the challenges associated with that as a high level. Are there you know, where did the kind of the bulk of the work on that particular piece take place? Or were there any like major, you know, what were the major challenges that you had to overcome on that the table interpretation part?
The finding the tables part or the LaTeX extraction?
The LaTeX extraction, the reverse engineering the right. tables, I guess.
Right, right. One issue is that the images are just bigger. There's just much more information in a table potentially than in a an equation that which has a lot of information, but a table is just can be a whole lot of numbers. It could be quite large, there we get into kind of memory issues with these convolutional neural networks. When you're training, for instance, if you have, you know, a large input image, you're restricted to how big a batch you can use at one time, and this will slow down training. And so the first challenge is that these things, you know, we're taking 2 weeks to train, which is, you know, it's hard to iterate on a problem when it takes so long to train. So we did some work. We happened to have received the new NVIDIA GPUs at that time. So that had 16-bit floating point capabilities, which are kind of theoretically going to be twice as fast, and you can kind of have twice as many weights stored in memory because you're only using half as many bits for them. So mm-hmm. we spent a lot of time trying to adapt to this 16-bit technology so we could have, you know, the speed up and the kind of access to put more stuff in memory, but it turned out to be much harder than we thought it would be. Mm-hmm. There are a whole bunch of kind of technical issues when we represented our weights in our network with only 16 bits. And it turns out we weren't alone. It turns out it's kind of a known issue at this point that you don't really want to store everything in 16 bits. You can do some calculations in 16 bits, but your weights of entry should be stored in 32 bits. So we spent a lot of time kind of working through that, okay. that problem. And what we're working on now is, I mean, so what's the basic issue with this table to LaTeX is that it looks fine, but it doesn't really work that well if you're going for an exact match, and we're going for an exact match, you know, 40%, that's 40% correct. That's pretty low by any, mm-hmm. by most standards. The equations were kind of more up like 80% exactly correct. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, and this is ongoing work.
Is your measure of correctness, is this like pixel, like, you know, pixel overlay, or is it something else?
So
is it more information based, I guess?
Right. Yeah. It's not information based. During training, it's during training time, we're just trying to maximize kind of the likelihood of the correct LaTeX. Mm-hmm. So that's training time. But when it actually comes to evaluation, we're going for exact pixel to pixel match. So it's binary. You either got it exactly correct or not. So what that means mm-hmm. is the input's the image of the table, the output's a string of LaTeX tokens. We feed that string into a LaTeX compiler. It renders an image. And then we compare that image pixel by pixel to the original image. And if it's an exact match, it's correct. And otherwise, it's incorrect.
And why do you care about that?
Why do we care about the exact match?
Why is your bar, I guess there are multiple ways to ask the question, like why do you care about kind of a LaTeX representation? Why do you care about pixel to pixel match? You know, why isn't it just that you've extracted the, you know, the rows and columns of data, the headings, the text, the numbers, all that stuff?
Okay, so there's a few things in there. Let's see. So LaTeX, I don't care about LaTeX per se. LaTeX is kind of a stand-in for a structured representation from which it should be easy to do the things you said, extract the rows and columns and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So why LaTeX? We happen to have access to a huge collection of real world LaTeX documents that have tables in them. And so that's kind of our label training set. We went to archive, we scraped out all these papers. We found almost 500,000 tables with the original LaTeX.
Oh, nice.
And so, yeah. So, I mean, we could have generated artificial tables, but it's really better to work with kind of real live natural data. So that's basically how we ended up with LaTeX. Then the question, why do we care about exact match? And, well, one reason is expedience, which is that it's easy to do, and it's actually quite difficult to figure out how you would score something that's not an exact match. I mean, you could do it in the image space where you have this kind of the image that's not an exact match, and then if you want to rate it by how off it is, you'd have to kind of do some alignment and find – and it seems like a very complicated problem in itself. And then you're asking, what about just measuring how it does in a downstream task, such as just finding the data, like, so extracting the data from the LaTeX, and you know, are the numbers correct, are the headers correct? And that would be possible. It's still very difficult to score. We actually have the same problem with when we're extracting data from scattered plots. You know, there's 60 points in the chart. The system finds 57. And the points, you know, have amounts of error ranging from 0.25% to 6%.
Somebody celebrating back there?
Yeah. Sorry about that. There's a kind of a awards thing going on just starting now next door to me.
So it sounds like in both the table and the scatter plots, you're using the visual domain and visual domain accuracy is really it's just a convenient intermediary for you to be able to test whether you've accomplished the goal, whether you're able to replicate the system. And because, at least in the case of the tables, and I think you're doing the same thing with the scatter plots, because the table that you're generating or predicting is generated via a structured representation. It doesn't really matter what it is, but you happen to have training data that's in LaTeX. Because you're generating it via a structured representation, you know that, you know, downstream you'll be able to pull the data out the way you need to.
That's right. Also, it's convenience to do in the image domain, but also it's hard to know exactly what downstream tasks we're going to want to do on the structured representation. Mm-hmm. And maybe there's important information in that boldface versus italics, which you might think isn't necessarily part of the core information of the table.
Great point.
The harder tables to extract, a lot of that complexity comes from things like hierarchical column headers or row headers or cells that span multiple rows or columns. And this is actually difficult to represent in a it's difficult to score the performance on those sorts of mistakes. Like, what if it didn't properly represent the cell as spanning two column headers or these sorts of things? So I guess yes, it comes down to simplicity, but also it just not being exactly clear how else we would score it in a way that would be, you know, good for any possible downstream task we'd want to do.
Yeah, no, that makes a ton of sense. Awesome. So you, in your presentation, you kind of go through these three sub projects. Were there any closing or parting thoughts that would make a good wrap up for us here?
Well, I guess one one thing that people often wonder about is, you know, what about all these people who are labeling documents and now are they going to be all automated away? And we're really not worried about it, not because we don't care about people's jobs, we absolutely do, but because the people doing the labeling are actually often fairly highly trained, and we'd love to have them working on harder and deeper problems that they'll have time for once the problems that a computer can solve are solved. So, you know, questions about, we can find the data and then we can flag things that are unexpected. Then the human can go and tag the unexpected behavior with perhaps linking it to a possible reason why. These sorts of things are more still human level tasks that it's not clear are automatable in the near future. And kind of automating the menial tasks will hopefully leave humans free to do the tasks that we don't yet know how to automate.
Mm.
And maybe are more like specific to needing human intelligence, at least for now.
And it sounds like in the example you gave, more valuable.
Right.
Awesome. Well, David, you've been very generous with your time. Thank you so much for chatting with us.
It's been my pleasure. Thanks so much.
All right, everyone. That's our show for today. For more information on David or any of the topics covered in this episode, you'll find the show notes at twimlai.com/talk/126. Thanks once again for listening, and catch you next time.